This is The Stream, an Allison and Partners podcast. After 2 years, we have decided to bring the podcast back. I'm Allie Warshavsky and will co-host with Owen Clark. We both came to Allison and Partners after time as TV journalists. We wanted to bring back The Stream to create a place where communications professionals like ourselves can ask questions about what the media is covering, why they are covering it, and how they're covering it.
We're going to get at those questions in a couple ways on the pod. We'll be breaking down trending topics. We'll take you inside the mechanics of an interview from both sides. We'll bring in subject matter experts, both our friends and Allison and Partners and others from the industry. Each episode will probably be a bit different, but the through line is what are the stories that matter right now and how do we understand them better? To kick things off, a great conversation with a veteran journalist about how they vet and cover products. They really sample everything they're sent. What can PR people do to land in a story every time? What do we do wrong? So a really fun conversation. Hope you enjoy.
It's a huge responsibility. Like I take it very seriously to say that something is cool. And we joke about this, but I will get my friends together or like, I have a very small team right now, but like we'll get together as a team. And Mike, we used to get together for happy hours to specifically choose which canned cocktails we're going to go in the July 4th gift guide. Yeah. We took it very seriously and it sounds so silly, but actually this is going, you know, this is going to post for perpetuity. Like, I think it's really important that no one can ever come back to us and be like, this thing sucked and you put it in your gift guide.
On today's podcast, we have Rajul Punjabi, Raj, as she likes to be called, of the Huffington Post. She's director of the brand new Voices vertical, which features the perspective and voices from BIPOC, queer, and other historically marginalized groups. Before she came to the Huffington Post, she served as senior editor at Mike.com and senior health editor at Vice. During her time as a journalist, she has become someone we consider an expert at putting together editorial gift guides, which are very popular this time of year. Welcome to the podcast, Raj.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me here. Really excited to talk about all of this.
After that intro, it's kind of confusing why we'd refer to you as a gift guide expert, but can you give us a brief history of your work putting together gift guides and your experience?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it kind of found me, and I found gift guides to be a really wonderful respite from the more kind of like journalistic, heavy-hitting pieces that we often did as health journalists and then lifestyle journalists, and they can be a very important counterpart. So I found it happened kind of organically. When I was the health editor at Vice, we often talked about issues that people had working out or leading a healthier lifestyle and just kind of being their best selves. And we found that there were products that ended up being really popular with our audience members. And they were not the kinds of things that generally were just on Amazon or, you know, marketed by the big brands as stuff that would help. So we started having approaching the topic with levity and putting together some like fun gift guides, like products for people who hate running but need to run or something like that. And it was kind of like just a way to make running suck less but still get your cardio in. And you know how Vice's voice is, it's a little bit snarky or not snarky, but just more playful. And I thought that was a really good time and the stories did well. So when I went to Mike and leaned more into lifestyle, we just did more of that. And it was more kind of very much tapping into what our audience was interested in, just looking at stats and stories and then saying, okay, there's a pandemic going on. People want candles and lotion and hand wash. And like, what are things that we can comfort people with, have a little fun and still try and kind of like stroke the economy at the same time.
Raj, you mentioned that there are two different types of gift guides, editorial and consumer. Can you describe which is which?
It's hard to describe the exact criteria that commerce consumer teams use because I have never been on one. But from what I've observed, there's a different criteria. These teams are paying a lot of attention to bestsellers in general. And this is really important. They're on Amazon reading reviews. Reviews are really important. They're from real people. So this is like very much based on what's already popular. Editors, when we say that this is an editor-fueled gift guide, it's kind of coming from a place of journalistic, I don't want to say ethics, but like a journalistic perspective and vibes. So we're getting together and talking about what kind of products we personally feel are underrated, kind of have made a difference in our lives personally, and things we kind of want to put people on. Like this smaller brand is doing something really cool. Mm. And again, the intentionality goes into it as far as like what's behind the brand, who's behind the brand. And that's more as I lean into identity, what we're talking about a lot more. Women owned brands are really important, BIPOC owned brands. And we want to bring these, the best products to the forefront. For example, we did a Black owned whiskey guide, which is like people don't even know that like a lot of whiskeys are coming out of the woodworks that are and that have been on the market that are, you know, Black women owned, and we want to support them. They're really good whiskeys. We drank them. And I think like, I love a good whiskey, but the big brands already have the attention. Like, why don't we put people on so you can be at a dinner party and be like, look at this amazing whiskey. It's so good. And I bet you guys have never had it before.
I'm sure you really hate that you have to try whiskey for work.
That is the most fun part of anything, especially with booze gift guides, because you're just, you know, trying to be classy and be unbiased. But like, really, at the end of the day, like the third or fourth whiskey and you're like, okay, I have to stop and continue this because they all taste good at this point. Yeah.
Every PR person's quasi nightmare is like one of these gift guide comes out and their client's like, why weren't we included? And we're like, we didn't even know it was happening. Like, you know, it's not something you like always publish that you're doing, or you just talk about like how you solicit input for a guide like this, or is it totally just sort of determined editorially through your group and what you choose to like? Like, how do you pick and criteria and take submissions for something like a guide you're putting together?
The communication around these product guides are so, so important. And I figured it out after years in the biz, right? And I will ask publicists who are, so many of them are my friends, and I'll be like, okay, this is kind of what I'm doing this season. Whatever fits in here, like, please pitch me. Even if it's like kind of on the periphery, but if it feels like it fits, like pitch me. For everything else, like, let's talk about it next quarter. Because I think there's like so many products and I get that. I totally get that. But I'm not the type of person that ignores emails. I find that like super obnoxious. I don't
care. Our favorite type of journalist, right? Who actually reads emails. This is a nice touch. Yeah.
Like ultimately the communication helps, right? Like if we both agree that we're just going to get at each other with the information that we actually want and need, then there doesn't need to be this like influx of information because everyone's clear on what we're trying to do. It's kind of like a relationship. Like there just needs to be like really good communication. And I think that's what really helps. And then my publicist colleagues will hit me with products that feel really fun that they might not have thought to pitch because they're, you know, it's not their account. It's their, you know, counterpart at the company's account or whatever it is, but everyone wins, right? When it's like a product from within a brand, really just communicating at the beginning that this is like what I'm trying to do. I only have a bandwidth for this many product guides. So like everything else, let's talk about it another time. And that's how I solicit interest and it's worked really well for me so far.
And you say you enjoy, again, it's sort of funny. You are this sudden like arbiter of taste in a lot of ways, right? Because so much of journalism, like you said, on the other side is pure reporting. And this all of a sudden you're like a trend maker, I guess. Is that enjoyable? Do you sometimes feel pressure to be this super sophisticated person who's giving all these reviews? Or I guess talk about what that role is like, you know, making these decisions on like what fits into a guy.
Oh my God. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a huge responsibility. Like I take it very seriously to say that something is cool. And we joke about this, but I will get my friends together or like, I have a very small team right now, but like we'll get together as a team. And Mike, we used to get together for happy hours to specifically choose which canned cocktails we're going to go in the July 4th gift guide. Yeah. We took it very seriously and it sounds so silly, but actually this is going to post for perpetuity. Like, I think it's really important that no one can ever come back to us and be like, this thing sucked and you put it in your gift guide. Like, it's super important that we need to stand by it. If it's like editors saying this thing, you know, it's not usually just me, honestly. Mm-hmm. It's at least a few people because I could try something and I could be totally off. So I need a consensus all the time. You know, there are products that companies will send me and I will hand it off to a teammate and be like, try this. What do you think? Because we all get biased from time to time, if it's like a certain brand or something like that. And like, yeah, it takes a village to choose a wonderful set of headphones.
Have you ever had one gift that you have liked and your team hasn't, and there's been a clear disagreement and you have doubted yourself?
You know, that has happened. And I'm laughing because some of these products that end up on Shark Tank, I don't know what happens to me. Like, I get completely brainwashed and I'm like, this thing is amazing. And my team is like, this thing is ridiculous. Like, we cannot do this. I'm not going to name names, but like certain like wellness products and like workout products are just so outlandish, but they were fun for me. But again, if other people are telling me like, this is actually not good for you know, a body type that's not like different from yours, or this feels like too expensive to suggest to someone in our age demographic. I take all of that into great consideration. And sometimes we will put something in a guide that stood out to one or two team members, and we'll put a caveat in there that says like, this is for someone who wants this, or like, you know what I'm saying? And I think being specific, that's why I think those little blurbs that go next to products are super important. I don't know if people read them, but they will tell you specifically like who this is for and why we loved it.
I think that criteria is super interesting too, right? Because there is like this whole, I mean, the distinction you made between the editorial and not, because there's obviously this other whole genre of true blue review sites, right? Consumer Reports being sort of the gold standard. Like if I worked in auto for a while and like there are very distinct, like CNET has very distinct criteria they'll do through their testing versus an editorial guide, which is obviously just sort of the opinion of a small few. Do you find that you have to constantly reset those expectations, or again, define what that is? So you're like, look, we're not saying we did 10,000 tests on this candle. This is just the candle we liked. Like, how do you articulate that? And do you think it's important for people to understand the difference between these different types of review processes?
On some level, readers kind of get it. Like we'll say in the introduction always like what our aim is, what our thesis is. Like, here's our favorite Diwali gifts. We just did one for like South Asian owned companies. And like, this is what we're doing. We did not sit down and vet like 1,000 of them. And I think that's a really hard job to look at one product and do that like 10 page review. But I think just through the way we're approaching it and just like the conciseness of the article, it comes across. But we definitely say a little bit about what we're trying to do in the introduction, that these are just our favorites. You know, these are and we do like, a running gear guide every year. So I think it's like every year here are like the hottest items of the season or whatever it is. I think that helps people get that we just kind of want to shove some products in your face to be like, this is awesome for us this year and you might like it too.
I really thought of this as holiday gift guides, but you mentioned 4th of July and running gift guides. But for the sake of the season, when do you start reaching out to start your Christmas and holiday gift guides?
I and so many of my fellow editors are so bad at like waiting until the last minute to do this. Like I will see PR emails from like September talking about holiday gift guides. And I'm like, oh, that's cute. Like I will look at that. But I really won't look at anything until the end of October. It's just there's like, you know, many of us have smaller teams, so we're doing a lot. So it's like, we don't get to what we're supposed to do until the very last minute. So I would say I start putting things together a month before Christmas for like the holiday gift guides. And we do like, I've done like Mother's Day and Father's Day, really fun ones, like gifts for your newly woke dad and things like that. But it'll be like, like a month before Father's Day, because if there are things that people do want us to try, like we would like to try them before deciding. But I would say like a month before any particular event is what it is. Like July 4th, there's a lot of booze guides. Same for New Year's. So like a month before is like the sweet spot.
People like us in the PR field are sending you these pitches. Have you ever gotten one that was like, wow, I need to try this? And how did it capture your interest? Was it a unique picture or a video?
That's also such a good question. Because we all know that any type of email, whether it's like a pitch or anything else, like some things just grab your attention quicker. I would say being very direct in the subject head is so important. Just like, tell me what it is. Also, some products are just weirder than others. Those always get our attention, like popcorn, nail polish that smells like popcorn or something like that. It's weird. And that's number one, like the weirdness will get our attention. But just with regular products that might work or that we might like want to consider right away, just being super direct and definitely offering a demo or a sample or something, being like, try this, even if it's for like a week or whatever it is. I think there's this like, there's some appeal to having like a tactile part of this email where like, okay, let's try this or figure out. And obviously images always help. And the other thing is super concise. I love a PR pitch that's like two paragraphs, you know, a few lines and that's it. And an image and being like, if you want to hear more, email us. To me, that's the ones that always garner the most interest, because even when we're doing articles, like the most hardcore journalistic articles, we know that past 700 words, like we're going to lose you. My sweet spot is always short and direct. I think like we can all agree that that's what's going to get your attention regardless of the product.
But we're all like failed writers and we want to write you this epic message that we've all like reviewed 19 times internally. It's true. It was the lesson of three lines and the information is so much more effective than my opus that I wrote and slaved over on those times. So I think we always need to hear it though. Again, maybe we save those drafts for later. Yeah, this is good here. I want to ask sort of like somewhat meta questions. We're evaluating sort of like the state of the media industry as well. The business aspect of these gift guides, they're obviously like SEO fodder, right? Overall, they may, and then, you know, you have potentially like these direct link outs to an Amazon page or piece. Like, I guess, have you heard or do you know that these are helpful for the business of the journalistic operations and staying afloat as they look for new ways to drive readers and interest? Like, has that been something you've seen over the years that there's, I won't say pressure, but an emphasis on things like gift guides because they are like economically viable for the publication?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's more so the commerce team. You know, there's affiliate links, which bring a small percentage of income in. And I can't speak on this in the most educated way, but it is, it does have a part, you know, it does play a part in bringing in attention and a little bit of money. But really, ultimately, the traffic is very, very important because I see it every day, like, people love coming to HuffPost's shopping section. It's really good. And it's like really, they have a great balance of description, review, and photos. And, you know, it's all the gift guides across the board. But I wouldn't say there's a pressure, especially on the types of gift guides that editors put together, because really it's more of a story than there are affiliate links, but it's really about bringing attention to these brands. There's a different type of motive behind it.
Is there an item that will always stick out to you, like something really strange that you were sent to try that you eventually added to a gift guide?
Oh my gosh, that's a really tough one. Let me think. There have been some really weird things. I need to figure out the name of the product, but it was one of my Shark Tank products that I loved. It looked like a little kind of skateboard kind of thing, but it touched the ground. So when you got on it, you would like twist on it and you get an ab workout. And it was also cardio. That Shark Tank product made it onto the list and it was so bizarre. And we ended up doing a Facebook Live on Vice that was like a version of our gift guide. And we had this this actor, Arturo Castro, trying out all of he's from Narcos, amazing, like very serious actor. And we had him trying out these like ridiculous products and he tried it and our audience loved it. I loved it. And I was like, I don't care if this is weird, this is going on the guide. And that was pitched to me. And when I first saw it, I was like, this is extremely weird. Fine. Can you please send it to me so we can try it? And it was amazing. Sometimes you just have to like let fun win at the end of the day.
That's a good story. I'm also just interested. I think that you just had such a fascinating experience working across like, I think what you sort of people might call like new media, right? Or certainly sort of digital first publications and hearing about like Facebook Live. I love what you say on your bio about so much of your time is debunking TikTok health trends. I guess, how have you found these other channels, this merging of like traditional editorial and social? Like, do you enjoy it? Is it sort of exhausting to try and feel like you have to produce on five different channels all the time? I guess, just what's your perspective been on sort of this shift to journalism and social being so interconnected?
I mean, I won't go too much into detail about how we all know this, but like sometimes the best things are really exhausting. Like, yes, it is really exhausting. Like you're going from TikTok to like on Instagram, then I haven't been on Facebook in a really long time, but you know what it is. Like you're just trying to be like, I want to make sure everyone knows about this. But it's the fun type of exhausting because think about it. When you get burned out on one medium, when I'm like, okay, I cannot write another sentence today. I'm like, let me see if I can like, if my writer will do a TikTok about this and we can figure that out. And it's just kind of keeping it fresh. And, you know, production wise, I don't know much about production, but I have teams that help me. So like the TikToks end up being really beautiful. And like the Facebook Live a few years ago that I told you about was really like gorgeous and wasn't highly produced. But ultimately I got to spend the day not writing and editing and like doing silly stuff with a celebrity with like products. Like, I think it's why I don't get bored. And it's like why I get excited about doing this stuff. So yeah, I mean, trying to get everyone's attention, especially like trying to stay young and relevant, but also trying to honor like, you know, older people who care about products in a different way and have a different level of money to spend on it. I think you have to kind of be everywhere, but it's switching that kind of mindset feels again, it's a big responsibility, and I take it really seriously, but you know, it's really fun to not do the same thing every day.
It's funny. I mean, me and Allie were both sort of like former like multimedia journalists, which was just like the term they used to like pay you less and make you do more, right? Or I was part of that generation. But like, it seems like nowadays to be a successful journalist, you really can't, you have to be cross-platform by definition. Is that fair to assume? Or I guess like you think if you were talking to I'm sure you do talk to 23-year-old journalists or 19-year-old journalists that they shouldn't think of themselves as I'm going to go into print or broadcast or digital. Like it's something that now you need to be able to cross across all those things.
And I've learned about the power of my own versatility through my Gen Z friends, truly. Mm-hmm. Like millennials have a lot to learn from Gen Zs. Like two of my closest friends who are journalists are 23 years old. And they are, you know, when I first asked them will you do a TikTok to accompany this story? They were like, oh yeah, I have 50K followers already. And I'm like, what? You do this other thing? Yeah. Like they do, there's no such, you know, it's just like jack of all trades, but like master of all trades. Like they're doing a bunch of stuff really well. And they came out the womb thinking of themselves as that. It's not just one mm-hmm. thing. And they do it with an ease that I really admire. I would love to get there where I do, you know, I have these other parts of me, like I play the guitar and, you know, like God knows, like it's very impressive. But on social media, yeah, I mean, I've never had to like, not to be like reverse ageist or whatever, but like, they're just better at this stuff. And I learn every day from it because it's an ease, right? Like we came up with a different ease than the generation before us. And there's just like always a lot to learn.
Nowadays, there seems to be more of a thought process of including products made from diverse backgrounds. When did everyone start to focus more on who is making the products and being more inclusive in these gift guides?
That's a really important aspect that I talk about all the time. And I'm like, I was at Mike for 3 years and we got really cocky about already, you know, cause we already had a lens on identity or we're looking at things through the identity lens. So we got really cocky about being like, oh, we do these like, you know, Black owned beauty gift guides already before everyone else. And everyone else really, I mean, this is something that we have to be completely honest about. Like, when the George Floyd uprisings happened, everyone had a quote unquote racial reckoning. And then companies were like, oh my God, what are we doing? We need to like have our eye on being more inclusive. I mean, look, better late than never, but it was really late. Like it mm-hmm. was really, really late that all brands and companies were like, oh, we need to think about like our clients and what feels more balanced. But it's happening. And, you know, a lot of brands, a lot of, journalistic outlets have a pledge when they're doing shopping guides that it's like 15 to 20% people of color owned or queer owned and things like that. And I think keeping that is really important. That happened, I would say, about two and a half years ago that this went into kind of policy. And that's really important. But I think, honestly, whether it was spoken about or not, if you're the type of journalist that cared about that before, you cared about it before, you care about it now, it's just always been a thing. So what is cool is I can be more direct now about when I talk to publicists and brands and stuff being like, you know, we're looking to feature Black designers in this piece. Like, who do you have that has, you know, design stuff? And that it is what it is. If you don't have someone that I feel like would be a great fit for this story, then, you know, on to the next one. I think we all have to think about highlighting extremely talented people of color and queer people at our companies. And you know, that needs to happen more and more and more.
And can you talk just a little more about specifically voices like the new parent? I mean, I think it's great that you said there of sort of like the difference between individual perspectives and efforts by journalists and sort of institutional changes or giving, frankly, a name to a beat, if you will, that didn't exist before. We see the same thing with like sustainability, environmental issues. Talk to about like how you created that and what your vision is for it.
I think that the, especially like when we're putting product guides together, it's so different on voices. The first one we did after I came on was about a month ago for the Indian New Year Diwali. So we did like a things to buy as a gift or for yourself. And it was so much fun because a lot of the products were South Asian owned, but other ones weren't. And we put this like very transparently in the intro. Other things were not, but they were just staples of Diwali. Like we put a beautiful scotch on there because like old Indian uncles love to drink scotch. And we had a couple of scotches because yeah. We're like, this is real. Like we drink at Diwali, like we cook. There was some beautiful, like colorful cookware. There were candles because it's the Festival of Lights. So, you know, it kind of felt very organic to include some bigger non-South Asian owned brands with some smaller South Asian owned brands that were amazing. And it came together so beautifully. The images were so pretty. And it was really fun to think about how we can translate these stories about cultural visibility into a product guide. Like, it doesn't have to be weird. It could be really fun.
It's similar to Ali's point earlier. Like, I guess, how can PR people best have that dialogue? You know, again, is it like, got a great black owned design? Is it just that straightforward and simple? Or like, I think there's always, because PR people tend to be like so risk averse. It's like, am I going to describe this the wrong way? I guess, what do you think is the best way to have that dialogue from a publicist standpoint and a journalist when you're talking specifically about diversity in products?
That's a great question. Again, just read the room. Like, any publicist that has corresponded with me ever, I will write back and be like, is this person a woman? Who owns this? Like, you know, I can't tell by the name. And I think after that, it's like, I've noticed a change in the tone and verbiage that publicists use with me. They'll be like, this is a woman-owned brand. This product has been really popular with Black and Brown beauty influencers. Like, it can get direct. I think just like reading the room, I think it's, again, like very relationshipy, like figuring out like how to talk to someone, because not everyone, unfortunately, is open to that. And like, you know, having a direct conversation. So I think I love, my favorite thing to do with like the person I'm working with that I think I will continue to work with is have a 30-minute Zoom or phone session or coffee. I think it's really underrated just to be like, this is who I am. This is what I do. This is what you need to know. And like, that's it. Like, I think the emails, even if they go on for years, are, it's really hard to build a rapport and figure out what each other needs through emails. Even if it's like, I've had 15-minute phone calls with people where we really hit it off and we're just like, okay, great. Got you. Like, this is what we, and then after that, it's like much more fluid. So I think, that first communication with someone, because it gets weird, right? It's kind of like if you go to the barista and like you've gone to this person for 2 years and you don't know their name. It's too late to ask for their name at that point. So like, it's really important at the beginning of a relationship to kind of establish like, this is who I am. This is what I do here. How can we help each other?
Thanks, Raj, and thanks for listening to this new season of The Stream. You can find more episodes wherever you get your podcasts.